And David said, "Is there still anyone left of the house of Saul that I may show him kindness for Jonathan's sake?" Now there was a servant of the house of Saul whose name was Ziba, and they called him to David. And the king said to him, "Are you Ziba?" And he said, "I am your servant." And the king said, "Is there not still someone of the house of Saul that I may show the kindness of God to him?" Ziba said to the king, "There is a son of Jonathan. He is crippled in his feet." The king said to him, "Where is he?" And Ziba said to the king, "He is in the house of Machir, the son of Ammiel, at Lodabar." Then King David sent and brought him from the house of Machir, the son of Ammiel, at Lodabar. And Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, son of Saul, came to David and fell on his face and paid homage. And David said, "Mephibosheth." And he answered, "Behold, I am your servant." And David said to him, "Do not fear, for I will show you." What will he show him? "I will show you the kindness of God for the sake of your father Jonathan, and I will restore to you all the land of Saul, your father, and you shall eat at my table always." And he paid homage and said, "What is your servant that you should regard for a dead dog such as I?" Then the king said, "Ziba, Saul's servant, said to him, 'All that belonged to Saul and all his house I have given to your master's grandson. And you and your sons and your servants shall till the land for him and shall bring him the produce, that your master's grandson may have bread to eat. But Mephibosheth, your master's grandson, shall always eat at my table.'" Now Ziba had 15 sons and 20 servants. Then Ziba said to the king, "According to all that my lord the king commands his servant, so that you will your servant do." So Mephibosheth ate at David's table, like one of the king's sons. And Mephibosheth had a young son whose name was Micah. And all who lived in Ziba's house became Mephibosheth's servants. So Mephibosheth lived in Jerusalem, for he ate always at the king's table. Now he was lame in both feet.
I've heard that story recounted many times, many times. Every author has his or her take on certain stories. They tell it their own particular ways. If I were telling the story, I'd tell it a little differently, however. If I were telling the story, I would add more color commentary to it. If you hadn't noticed, it was really just a presentation of the facts there. There wasn't much commentary about it. So if you wouldn't mind indulging me, I'd like to tell you the story with my commentary attached to it. Maybe I should introduce myself before I do. You're looking at a good citizen of Jerusalem. I know what you're thinking. Doesn't this area of Jerusalem cost much more than any other area? To which I would say, yes, this is the River Oaks of Jerusalem. I'm what you might call a man of means. I've done well for myself. Maybe you know this about the neighborhood too. In terms of real estate, this particular part of the neighborhood, the part that backs up to the walls of the palace, this part is particularly valuable. I pay a premium to live here. Now, it's a great neighborhood, but why this spot in particular? I want to tell you why. Because this spot, right where I'm living with the king's wall, the king's palace wall in my backyard, it pays dividends. Not financial dividends, not the kind that are tangible. It pays intangible benefits. The benefits I receive from living so close to the king's palace are that I see everyone and everything that goes in to the palace, the court of the king. I see all the traffic that goes through. I could probably tell you what the king has for dinner every single night based on what they bring through the gates of the palace. I can even tell you what people were invited or what people decided to show up to dinner at the king's palace. And best of all, right out my window of my kitchen, I can hear the gossip of the servants as they start to leave the palace. And I learned so much about what goes on behind closed walls just by where I decided to buy a small plot of land. I suppose it's out of that gossip, out of the stories I've been hearing lately, that I want to begin my story, my version of the story you just heard. I might call it my complaint against King David. What makes the city of Jerusalem so great are the people of Jerusalem. And what makes the people of Jerusalem so great is the class that these people have, the poise, the ability to comport themselves in a way that is unparalleled with any other city in any other nation. The old timers used to call it righteousness, and they would like to say this is the fruit that God has produced in our society, but ever since King Saul came about, he never used words like that, and he turned out just fine. In fact, he was an upstanding citizen. He didn't finish well, and that's a different story for a different time. But I tell you, I had respect for King Saul. He was a good-looking man. He ruled well. He ruled with power. He ruled with authority. He's the kind of guy I might like to be like. So, we do live according to certain rules. Our society does have these unwritten laws that good citizens are expected to abide by. Now, I know David. I know what he was about, King David. He did many things. He won many battles. He consolidated the kingdom. He established it, but he did some things that I simply cannot abide as a good, long-standing citizen of this great nation. The king, above anyone else, should be the one who has the greatest poise, the greatest sense of decency than anyone in the entire nation. Why? Because he is the face of the nation. So when people look at King David, they see the representative of our nation. And that's why I take issue with some of the things he has done, because he is misrepresenting the good people of this great city. The first thing I want to share with you, something that made me particularly annoyed, was that he did the most uncouth thing. It doesn't sound bad when it starts out. He started by saying, "Is there anyone left in the house of Saul?" Now, I don't know what you know about monarchy, but most of us expected we knew what came next. When you have a monarchy, it's very important right at the outset to establish your authority. Who's in charge here? Every monarch I've known, every monarch in the whole known world, the ancient Near East, follows these same rules. You call up any remaining relatives from the previous monarch because they pose a threat to your kingship. You don't know what old ties, old allegiances they might have, that if they just stir the pot enough, they might create an uprising and overthrow you. People don't get to vote on a king, but they can still vote through their actions. This kind of social norm that I'm describing, it's not pretty business, but it is the expectation that all of us have for our king. We want a show of force, of power and authority, which is why what he did after learning that there was one remaining person in the house of Saul was deeply offensive for me and my peers. They brought the king a man named Mephibosheth. He was Jonathan's son, which made him King Saul's grandson, which, if you do the math, makes him the direct successor to King Saul, if Saul were on the throne. This man poses a threat to King David, which is why his actions were so astonishing and unusual. He did not follow social protocol. I heard Mephibosheth talking to his wife right at the end of that same day when I first saw Mephibosheth standing at the gate waiting to go into the entrance to the palace, shaking in his boots. He was intrepid with fear. But when he came out, his wife met him at the gate, and I could hear what they were saying. I wasn't trying to hide at that point. And he said, "You'll never believe what the king just asked me to do. I get to eat at the king's table every single day. What does the king want with a guy like me?" What kind of king does that? What kind of king indeed? My friends were in uproar. This is a different way of being a king, and we, the influencers of our society, we do not approve. But we shouldn't be so surprised. King David belongs to a class of people I might characterize as nouveau riche, new money. You know what I mean by that? There are folks of old money, where money has been in their family for generations, so they've had the history to develop this wonderful rapport, this posture. They know the social responsibility it requires to handle money in an upstanding and respectable kind of way. But those with the new money, they don't have any sense of how to behave when you're of a person of means. Do you know what David used to be? A shepherd boy. A shepherd boy. The lowest of the low. It's like he won the greatest inheritance on earth, and now he's king and has unending riches. He has no idea how to behave. No idea what the social expectations might be, so I guess I shouldn't be surprised by his actions toward Mephibosheth. But that was just the beginning of his abandonment of our important social principles. Take, for example, what he did next. What he did next just upset the fabric of our society so much that I can hardly contain it. It's Mephibosheth wasn't alone. He was the only person remaining from Saul's family, but Mephibosheth had a servant. The servant's name was Ziba. And it was like once King David started noticing this dead dog named Mephibosheth, it's like he got caught up in it, like he got addicted to it, like he just needed more. And it became catalytic. Not only is Mephibosheth now going to eat at your table, but Ziba is now going to be brought onto the payroll of the palace. And you know they pay well at the palace. And then it was not only Ziba, it was all of Ziba's sons, and it was all the rest of the remaining servant staff that once served King Saul's house. King David just didn't notice Mephibosheth. He noticed Ziba, and he noticed Ziba's sons, and then he noticed the rest of the servants. It was this waterfall, this domino effect of David's decency, sullying the reputation of our good nation. What kind of king does that? I was more than annoyed because my neighborhood, the one that we pay extra so that the streets stay nice and clean and neat, suddenly they were being trafficked by all of Ziba's sons and all the other servants, probably 30 or 40 people, back and forth, back and forth. These people have no idea how to behave in a neighborhood like mine. What if everyone started to notice the unnoticed? Can you imagine the chaos that would ensue? I mean, What would happen if manual laborers who were just doing a day's work, digging a ditch, suddenly thought that they were as good, just as qualified to be in a neighborhood as the most upstanding, wealthiest, well-known, polished reputation kinds of people that I hang out with? The social strata that we live according to would be upended, and people would start thinking that everyone is just as valuable as everyone else, and a slave would think that they were just as valuable as their master, and a female would start thinking that they're just as valuable as a male. Can you imagine living in a world like that? I wish that were the limits of the scandal of King David's actions. But I've saved the best part for last. Or shall I say the worst part? Mephibosheth was a cripple. Not the good kind of cripple, if there is such a thing. I mean, the part that's kind of hard to look at. You know what I mean? He couldn't even walk right. I mean, it was so obvious that he had this deformity even from birth that you just wanted to stare. Imagine, if you will, the juxtaposition. Let me set the scene for you. It's David's banquet room where he eats dinner every night. On the finest china is served the best prepared meals made with the most incredible ingredients using spices that most people haven't even heard of before. They serve the best wine available anywhere in the ancient world in goblets of cut crystal. The room is covered with the finest silks. They have the most impressive wait staff available so that any need you might have, the servants are immediately there to meet that need. Everything is perfect. And then Mephibosheth hobbles in. And the clanking and the clattering of his crutches echoes across the polished marble floor. He's wearing nice clothes, but they're draped off of him in an awkward fashion because his body shape isn't quite right, so it just doesn't look right. He can't even sit at the table by himself. He needs a servant to come and assist him just to sit at the table. That's the table where generals sit, where ambassadors from other countries sit. That's the table where the most elite sit, the most influential, the most talented, the most wealthy. Why is Mephibosheth sitting at the table of the king? What kind of king does that? I have often wondered what game King David must be up to by doing what he's doing, and I can't figure it out. It would seem to me that if you go to such effort to show kindness to someone, certainly there's got to be something in it for you. But as I look, all I can see is that it actually costs us, it costs David to notice someone like Mephibosheth. I don't see any gain in it whatsoever. It costs his reputation. I mean, what if an ambassador who was thinking that they were going to take over Israel were to come in and pretend like they were going to be a good-natured kind of person and realize that David invites weakness into his very inner chamber to eat with him? That enemy would more than likely think, If there's one source of weakness here, there's got to be 1,000 other sources of weakness. We can take this place. Or what if Mephibosheth himself decides, you know what? I should be the rightful heir to the throne. And he gets together his servants and all his old allegiances from the military and decides to lead a coup. I mean, David is inviting disaster into his very inner chamber. Why doesn't he see that? But I suppose if there's anything to be gained by this charade, I suppose I've seen Mephibosheth become a changed man. I don't like to give much, but I have to admit that there is something here. When I first saw Mephibosheth, he was trembling at the gates of the palace. He didn't know what was lying in wait for him. But over the days and the weeks and the months, I see him going in and out and in and out of the palace every single day. And nowadays, he looks different. He's still a cripple, of course. That hasn't changed and it won't change. But he walks around with his chest puffed out and he smiles a lot. And he just seems excited for what has gone on. The servants are not much different. And that really bugs me. Because the only thing that's really changed about their lives is that when they were once condemned, they have now been promised a new life and been approved by the king. But they're still servants. I mean, I don't understand why they're so positive just as a result of hanging out with King David. I am deeply offended by the actions of the monarchy. So are my friends. I simply can't believe the only thing King David gains by showing kindness to Mephibosheth and all the servants is that they receive some sense of dignity. But what about the king? I mean, what good is it to care for other people if it doesn't have any benefit to you? Of what use is a kingship if you give away your dignity to someone who is less deserving? What kind of king chooses to feast each and every day with people who are broken and hurting and in need of some kind of hope? What kind of king does that? Our Lord Jesus Christ, our King of Kings, on the night he was betrayed, took bread, and when he had given thanks, he broke it and gave it to his disciples, saying, "Take, eat. This is my body broken for you. Do this in remembrance of me." In the same way, also after supper, he took the cup and he said, "This is the new covenant in my blood. Do this in remembrance of me. For as often as you eat this bread and drink this cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes again." Brothers and sisters, these are the gifts of God for the people of God. Will you pray with me? Father, you are our great King. You are the Lord of Lords. And you, even more than King David, have demonstrated the remarkable, impossible to conceive of idea that your power is meant for the broken. That your goal is not to notice those who are most righteous, but those who are least righteous. That this table and your death and the forgiveness that it offers is meant for the least of these, because God, you have noticed the unnoticed. Lord, as we now take of this meal at your table, would you lead us to do the same as we look to find the unnoticed in our midst? In the name of Jesus Christ, amen.